Listen to Learn Audio Tapes presents Depression, A Disorder of Power by Dr. Susan Heitler. Dr. Susan Heitler is a clinical psychologist in private practice at Rose Medical Center in Denver and the author of the widely acclaimed book, From Conflict to Resolution. This tape was recorded with the participation of psychology students at the University of Denver. And now, Depression, A Disorder of Power with Dr. Susan Heitler.
Depression. I'm going to give you examples of three different situations that have come up in therapy sessions, of three different individuals who've come with some difficulties with depression. Your job is to figure out what do these three individuals share in common that has led all three of them to feelings of depression. Case one, let's call her Bonnie. Bonnie is a married woman with two children, who's been experiencing her life as if it had a dark cloud over it. She's usually somebody who's enthusiastic and enjoys taking care of the children, has lots of friends, but somehow for the last several weeks, she's just felt dark, down on herself, saying negative things to herself about herself, like, oh, your house is so messy, or, gee, don't you have a brain in your head, or, you have no sense of humor, that kind of a comment. Which is uncharacteristic for her, because usually she's quite self-accepting. She's also noticed that she's been irritable with her children. Instead of being patient and finding the children amusing, she's quick to bark at them. One evening, she and her husband get into a difficult talk. It starts peaceably and then escalates into somewhat of an argument. They're not the kinds of people that like to argue, so they both drop it off before it gets too loud or too angry. But it goes something like this. Bonnie says, you know, I really wish you could get back from work earlier, and when you do come home, that you'd have more time for me and for the kids. Her husband, let's call him Clyde, says, you're always nagging at me about this. You know, I have lots of responsibilities. It's a new job. I'm very anxious. I can't start asking for special favors. This is impossible. She says, you know, it gets later and later that you're home for supper. Then you go hide behind your newspaper. He says, I am so exhausted by the end of the day. I can't deal with you and the children. You have those kids so that they're so irritable. You're barking at them. They're whining at you. It's too much for me. Get off my back. She says, okay. I mean, if you can't do it, you can't do it. That's scene one. That's Bonnie. What does that scene have to do with Carl? What is similar? And this is a tricky question, a difficult question. We see Carl in his kitchen, sitting at the table with his head in his hands. He has no energy. The newspaper is in front of him, but he can't get himself to even open it, never mind turn to the classified pages, which is where he has to look. He has been out of a job for quite a while and tried and tried and tried to get a new job, but just can't seem to do it. He's about 50 years old. He thinks maybe this is because of my age. He's also been out of work for quite a while because he had a serious illness. He's depleted, discouraged, feels very hopeless, like nothing he can do will be any help. Scene three. This is Jack. So we've had Bonnie and Carl, and now we have Jack. Jack also has no enthusiasm, which is very strange because Jack's a big, tall, athletic-looking fellow, played lots of sports in college and high school, has always done well at whatever work he's done, always looks for the most challenging jobs, enjoys relationships, enjoys sports, full of gusto and joie de vivre. Only for about the past 2 months, he's had no enthusiasm. He gets out of bed, but with some effort in the morning. Whereas usually he's full of enthusiasm and appetite for life, now he has no appetite, hardly even for eating, very little appetite for his work. He's just going through the motions. About 2 months ago, when this depression started, the woman that he had been dating and was hoping even to marry abruptly cut off the relationship. It just wasn't going to work, she said. What do those three incidents have in common? Clearly, from the silence, it's not immediately obvious. Yes?
They lack energy.
They lack energy.
They all feel hopeless.
Keep going. What else do they have in common?
They each spend a lot of time in the same place, like at home.
Oh, interesting. Their lives are becoming constricted.
Low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Down on themselves. Those are all symptoms that they share in common. How did all of them end up with those symptoms of what we would label clinically as depression? What did their situations have in common?
The first woman, she lost the affection of her husband and the attention, and the second person lost his job, and then the third person lost their fiancé, so they've all lost something that they cared about.
One of the commonest conceptions of depression is that it's like grief. It is triggered by an experience of loss, and that is one very good way to see what they have in common. My own theory is that loss is part of the story, but not the whole story. To understand depression and why loss is such a strong trigger for depression, you need to look at conflict. Conflict and loss, what do they have to do with each other? Loss is a situation where we are in conflict. There's something we want, and we're not getting it. That's the basic conflict involved in loss. There's more conflict involved. Let's take them one by one and see what's involved in the particular pattern of handling conflict in those three situations. Remember Bonnie and her argument with her husband Clyde? How would you describe the pattern that their discussion took? Was it one of mutual listening that ended up with a win-win solution? I see your head shaking no. You want to comment on how it sounded to you?
It sounded like they were both avoiding because they would start out, but then they would withdraw before it got too heated.
They certainly withdrew before they reached a conclusion that was satisfactory to Bonnie. Why do you think Bonnie withdrew from the discussion?
Because she didn't want to antagonize or add on to the situation to make it worse, to get him in a worse mood.
And make the situation worse. What could have happened if he got more antagonistic towards her?
Well, and I guess in the worst case scenario, violence.
Violence is one of the worst case scenarios. There's another worst case scenario.
He would have left her.
Right. The ultimate threats are either violence or that he would leave her. She basically made a choice. Rather than risk either violence or an ending to the relationship, she chose to just drop the discussion, drop her efforts to get what she wanted. The price she paid was depression. So we see that in the first example, Bonnie and her husband Clyde, in settling their conflict, what she wanted and what he wanted in the way of evening routines, to resolve that conflict, he dominated. What he wanted was expressed, his concerns were expressed at least a little, and prevailed. Hers were hushed up. She basically gave up. With a dominant submissive solution, along comes depression with the person who submitted, who gave up. What was the giving up for Carl, the man who was sitting at his kitchen table?
Hope.
Your response is exactly right. Hope is what he gave up on. Along with giving up hope, he gave up his efforts to find a job. What was the conflict there? Between what and what? Between his desire to get a job and the reality of the situation, which was turning out to be that obtaining a job was very difficult. So now we've seen the first conflict was between two people. The second was between a person and the realities of his situation. The third one is a little bit complex. Remember Jack, whose girlfriend abruptly said, "That's it. Goodbye, Jack." That's the one that most directly sounds like a loss situation. It's more than a loss, though. Who had the power in that situation? Clearly, she did. She said goodbye. Jack had very little power. As we'll see as we explore Jack more, what bothered him even more than the ending of the relationship, because the fact was he had some concerns about the relationship also, what really bothered him was the sudden total loss of power. So if we go back to the situation, how much power did Bonnie have? Very little. How much power did Carl in job hunting feel that he had? Virtually none. How much power did Jack feel that he had vis-a-vis his girlfriend? Virtually none. What we're seeing is that when conflicts are resolved in a dominant, submissive way, with a winner and a loser, that can occur for either of two reasons. Because the side that's dominating has a lot more power or is doing something that appears powerful, like expressing anger. Or dominant-submissive interactions can occur because the submissive side has given up. And in either case, and usually there's pieces of both, the result will be depression. Let's look what will help Bonnie and Carl and Jack, and what in fact did help them, to change their mode of dealing with their conflicts from a dominant-submissive mode to a cooperative, win-win kind of problem-solving. Remember, depression is a disorder of power. So somehow, in order to get to a win-win way of solving their conflict, they're going to have to get empowered or re-empowered. Now let's look at what power means. What's the difference between power and control? Do I need control over someone to be empowered as a person? Someone had a comment there.
Some people do.
Certainly some people think they need to control the other person in order to have personal power. Do you believe that? That you have to be able to control the other person in order to have personal power? You can be powerful by understanding the steps which enable conflicts to move to resolution and guiding conflicts along that pathway, rather than to have control over the other person and to be coercive or to make them do what you want, which would just be a dominant-submissive interaction where you're the dominant one, the controlling one. Anytime one party in a conflict thinks that control and power are one and the same and tries to be powerful by controlling the other, they're actually setting up to cause the other person to feel what emotion?
Depression.
Depression, exactly. To have to be submissive, to give up on what they want, to have a win-lose situation, and therefore to experience depression. What we're looking at when we're talking about power is not control over others, but rather a sense of personal power and the ability to get what one wants. That's what power is. Hopefully, really powerful people manage to get what they want at the same time as they facilitate other people in getting what they want as well. Let's look at the techniques that helped Bonnie, Carl, and Jack re-empower themselves and return to the situations that had bothered them, this time to get solutions that were not dominant-submissive, but rather were win-win. Let's take Bonnie, the mom who had to deal with her husband, Clyde, who worked too much and didn't seem to want to be with the family. Bonnie and Clyde could come in and work together in a therapy situation so they could learn to hear each other better and to negotiate with each other better. In this case, for various reasons, Clyde couldn't come in, so it was up to Bonnie to at least stop being submissive, even if she couldn't control Clyde's attempts to be dominant in the relationship. Let's look at what Bonnie did. I asked Bonnie to close her eyes. As I say this, close your eyes. As you listen to the visualization, you can picture it that way. So, close your eyes. Picture Bonnie and Clyde in their argument. Notice who seems bigger. I said to Bonnie, who seems bigger as the two of you are fighting? You or your husband? She laughed. He's way bigger, she said. I'm very small, and he's huge, like a giant towering over me. We see the power differential, so I suggested to her, Bonnie, look up, and you'll notice something sprinkling down on you, something very delicate, maybe silver, maybe yellow. She said, no, it's green. Whatever color you're picturing, some sort of powder-like sprinkles coming down on her. As these sprinkles fall gently down on you, Bonnie, you'll see yourself growing, almost like Alice in Wonderland, growing very tall. Right now, Bonnie, how tall are you? Bonnie said, well, I'm about the same size as him. So I said, does that feel comfortable, like how you'd like to be? She thought for a while and she said, I'm not sure. So I said, look up. Here come more sprinkles, more growing powder. She grew bigger. So I asked her, how much bigger are you now? She said, greatly bigger, about 4 or 5 times his size, so I can look down on him. As you look down on him, I said, what can you notice now that you're so much bigger that you couldn't notice before? She looked thoughtfully, and she said, he's all puffed up. What I thought was such a big giant size was because he's puffing himself up so that he'll look bigger than he really is. Really underneath that, he's rather scared. And I can see also that it's as if he has earplugs on or earmuffs or something covering his ears, so he can't really hear anything that I'm trying to tell him. So I asked, why would he not want to hear what you're telling him? What can you see now that you're big looking down that helps you to understand why his ears are blocked to what you tell him? She said, well, he's frightened. He's frightened that what I'm telling him is that he's in some way bad. And I know he's a good person, but when I tell him I'm unhappy, I think he hears me saying that he's a bad person. With this new information, Bonnie felt quite different. I said to Bonnie, you can open your eyes, and you may open your eyes now. I said, Bonnie, now that you're in this larger, more empowered size, you can see some things about Clyde that give you very important information. Now that you see what you see, how could you begin to approach your discussion with him in a new way that might have different results? That's what Bonnie did. It's very interesting what the results were. The next day when she tried again to talk with Clyde, she approached it in a very gentle way. She began exploring with him what she'd been feeling, why she spent so much of her day thinking about when he'd get home, and why that in turn would set up for her to be so excited when he'd walk in the door and therefore so disappointed when he just wanted to calm down, veg out, escape. She began to see also, the more she was exploring her own feelings, that part of the reason why she thought about him all day was there wasn't enough to think about during the day. She just wasn't the kind of person that was comfortable all day, every day, being at home with children. She had advanced degrees. She had a lot of skills. She had a lot of energy. She wasn't putting to use a lot of those sides of her, being a full-time homemaker. The solution she came up with was an interesting one. It was a genuine win-win solution that actually helped Clyde as much as it helped Bonnie. She decided she would go back to work part-time. That took the pressure off him because she was excited to be back with the kids in the afternoon after she'd been out for 4 or 5 hours in the morning. She wasn't burned out or irritable by the time her husband came home. Therefore, when he walked in the door, He began to be hungry for her attention instead of her looking for him. Furthermore, she was earning some extra money, which took some of the pressure off Clyde. He felt less panicky about his job and a little bit more able to be assertive with his boss to start setting limits on how much work he'd do and what kind of work he'd do. All of that came from shifting the power structure, shifting the power by shifting the submissive person's sense of loss of power. Let's look what happened with Carl. What's going to help him? Remember Carl sitting at the table, feeling very hopeless. The reality is that getting a job when you've been out of the job market as an adult for a considerable period of time, as he had been, is very difficult. Furthermore, starting fresh when you're 50 can be very difficult. Employers are concerned about, gee, will I be paying retirement in no time? At the same time, the more Carl focused on his hopelessness, how bad it was, all the reasons why he would not be able to get a job, the more he was making his hopeless feelings even worse. Somehow, he needed to get himself to switch around and look at what could be rather than what wasn't working, to convince himself that, hey, he'd just have to keep plugging at it. I told him a story that had been very important to me in understanding what Seligman has termed learned helplessness. Learned helplessness is the learning that no matter what I do, it's not going to do any good. What Seligman found in coining that term, learned helplessness, is that some people have a kind of persistence and determination that even when a situation seems hopeless, they will always keep looking for yet another solution. Those are the people that survive. The incident that was so dramatic for me in understanding this survival instinct that keeps people trying even when a situation is helpless involved a woman at a workshop much like I'm giving today. I had given a little example to help them understand what evokes depression. I had said, say you were in a room in an office and you had been working late and then finally you finished your work, you get up to go, you go to the door and it's locked. It's somehow locked in a way that from the inside you can't get the door open. What would you do?
Is there a telephone?
Sure, first thing you'd look for is a telephone. When I give this example to people, some people will just suggest a phone and then give up at that. Some people will come up with, well, I'd try to pry open the door, I'd look at the windows, I'd check out how far a drop it is, I'd knock on the walls, see if there's somebody nearby. Once when I gave this example, there was one woman who kept coming up with ingenious idea after ingenious idea. Some of them seemed crazy, like they wouldn't work, yet a lot of them had a lot of ingenuity to them. But what impressed me most was she kept trying. Then she'd keep trying, and she'd keep trying. Well, after the workshop, I went over to her, and I asked, what is it about you and your life that in a situation which for most people would engender either anger or depression, either they'd get mad at somebody and sit there and stew, or they just would sit and feel hopeless at some point. For you, you just kept going and going and going with solution after solution. She said that when she was about 7 years old, the Holocaust was going on. She was in Germany. She and her older sister and her mother went into hiding. They went from place to place, forest to forest, here, there. For 5 years, they stayed in hiding, avoiding danger after danger and just going and going and going, which said to me, oh, if one can persist and persist, you make it through even the most desperate situations, like she and her sister and her mother, all of whom did survive together. I told that story to Carl, getting back to Carl at his kitchen table. We talked about that he could spend his time dwelling on all the reasons why getting a job was so difficult for him, or he could spend his time, even if it felt like banging his head against the wall, just trying and trying, job lead after job lead, career path after career path, talking with people, etc. Now, Carl is a successful commercial real estate salesman having a great time. So that's giving up or submitting vis-a-vis a conflict that has to do between a person and the realities of his situation. Now let's go to our third case. Jack, whose girlfriend abruptly said goodbye. Now Jack's situation was very interesting. When he came in and described the lack of enthusiasm, the general downer feeling, the lack of appetite that he'd been having, he had no idea what that change in his temperament had come from. No idea whatsoever. I asked him to close his eyes. So all of you maybe close your eyes so you can picture what he saw. The question when somebody has no idea of why they're depressed is, if you were going to be angry at someone right now, irritated or maybe really mad, who would you be angry at? Anyone other than yourself? Who comes to mind that you could be mad at right now? Jack pictured his girlfriend. The next question, what do you see her doing? And how do you see yourself responding? The image he had was, well, it's like she just took a knife and cut the connection that was between us. Whoom, whoosh. The next question was, what is it that you're wanting? So the first question is, who are you angry at? Second question is, what happened? And then third is, what do you want? Well, what I think I was wanting there was to look together at that connection between the two of us and make a decision together about what we were going to do about it. How could you get what you want now? I mean, you know that she's not going to come back as your girlfriend. She made that real clear. But how could you accomplish what you want now? What he pictured was, well, if I could get her to meet me somewhere for coffee, just to talk for a bit in a public place, doesn't have to be anything intimate or too close, then maybe we could talk this ending over in a way that would give me a sense that this was a shared decision, even though I know it's a foregone conclusion. You can open your eyes. He did do that. He got back in touch with her and arranged for them to just talk for a few minutes over coffee. What do you think happened to his feeling state after that dialogue? Well, if you think that he felt better, you're absolutely right. Did he have his girlfriend back? No. What he did find, though, is once the decision felt like a shared decision, rather than that it had been done to him, once he was no longer in the submissive position, the loss was something he could deal with. He was a little sad that she wasn't in his life anymore, but sadness is not the same as losing all his energy and his joie de vivre. In fact, he was surprised that the sadness wasn't even completely gone away before he found he was looking at other women, beginning to make contacts for new relationships and moving forward in his life. There was a dominant-submissive interaction ending the relationship that had taken what would otherwise have been a grief reaction and converted the grief, the loss reaction, into a depression. The one kind of dominant-submissive interaction that we haven't talked about yet can be illustrated by another incident that happened to Jack at another time. This involved actually his job situation. Jack had a job that paid a lot of money. He had accrued some debts over the years and besides really likes the good life jet-setting around. He was very pleased with the money at his job. At the same time, the work was basically boring. It just wasn't challenging, technical enough to really compel his interest. He felt an inner dilemma. But the same as has happened in the situation with the girlfriend, instead of focusing on his conflict, he was just pedaling on with his life, staying in the job, not aware of what his low-key depressive feelings were about. I had him close his eyes and picture what he could be angry about. He pictured the job. This time, the conflict was not really between him and the job, though. It was between him and him. One side of him was saying, hey, that job makes good money. The other side was saying, I just don't enjoy it. Only it was one side saying, that job makes good money, and the other side saying, I really don't enjoy it. Again, a power differential, with one side just being smothered or not being heard. When he brought to awareness both sides of that conflict, he began to look seriously for a solution that would meet both sides. In fact, as of 2 weeks ago, he's in a new job which doesn't pay quite as much money, does pay enough that he can basically keep his lifestyle, and is very exciting. Makes a product that his engineering skills are needed for, and a product that he's really proud to be associated with. The zing is back in his life. Let's add one more piece. The pathway to depression is actually a neurological kind of pathway in the brain. If that pathway has been triggered early on, and the chemicals associated with depression have been aroused early on for people in childhood by upsetting traumatic losses or abuse or situations that they had no empowerment in, then people who've suffered those early depressions and early losses will be more prone to more quickly experience depression later in their life, to more quickly give up or be submissive. As a result, in addition to actually changing the conflict pattern, for many people, medication is a big help in dealing with repeated depressive feelings. Depressive medications strengthen people's body chemistry and make up for the changes that seem to happen in childhood for people who've suffered repeated losses or difficulties. The reason I bring this up is that I don't want anybody hearing the kinds of things we've talked about today to feel like, oh, if I'm depressed, I should be able to simply do these visualization techniques on my own and things will be quickly hunky-dory. It would be nice if things were that simple. In reality, it's not so. Most of us, if we've had basically normal childhoods and we're dealing with a normal level intensity kind of depression, then we probably can pull ourselves out of it. On the other hand, if we've had a tendency to depression, or if we have a family history of tendency to depression, or if we bump up against a really difficult conflict that we're giving up about, it's really important to get help. And the help may need to include an antidepressant medication, as well as help readdressing the conflicts and finding win-win solutions to them. Any questions? Yes.
Can you explain one more time the difference between control and power?
Great question, because it's really a key to all of this. Let's return to Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie was feeling quite powerless, very small. If she regained control by going home that night, putting her hands on her hips, saying, Clyde, I've had it with you. I don't care what's going on at your job. You're showing up at 5 o'clock sharp, and you're going to sit and talk with me, and you're going to be nice to your kids, or you're out of here. She's exerting real control over him. Yes.
Isn't that the same problem, but just reversed?
Exactly. Exactly. They're switching who's one up and who's one down, but the pattern is still dominant submissive if she's telling him what to do. What we're looking at as her being more effective in conveying what she wants and her being more effective in exploring solutions to what she wants, whether or not he changes what he's doing. Is that clarifying the difference between control, which is exerting power over somebody else, and power, which is using your energies to get what you want, independent of what the other person is or isn't doing? It's that re-empowerment that's the key to feeling good after somebody has gotten into a state of depression. Yes?
So say you're seeing two people independently, and you don't know about it, and they're like, well, you know, this guy, the guy, you know, he's so overpowering, and then so you tell the girl that, you know, what you just said, and she becomes more overpowering. And then the guy comes in, he says, God, she's so overpowering all of a sudden. I mean, what am I supposed to do? How do you control a conflict when you're telling both people to go for broke, basically?
What I'm telling them each to do is not to become overpowering, which would be controlling the other, but to become empowered, E-M-P-O-W-E-R-E-D. Empowered, not overpowering. But that question is a very, very good question for another reason, which is that when a couple is having problems, both of them need to make changes. And because of that, they both need to come to therapy together. A lot of couples think that if one of them is depressed, just the depressed person needs help. Or that maybe they should each get their own therapist. If just the depressed person gets help and the depressed person is married, the odds are very high, and this has been shown with good research, that either after she gets better, he'll get worse, or after she gets better, the marriage will get worse. They need to come in together and make changes side by side. Furthermore, if they each get separate therapists, the odds are very, very high that they will end up divorced. They will each get undepressed and unangry, but they will be divorced. And then the price is paid by the children. So if somebody is depressed and they're married, becomes very, very important that the help they get is one therapist for them and their spouse. Now, you may say, well, it's not the spouse's fault. It's not the spouse's fault. But most depression comes from marital interactions. Therefore, both parties need to make changes. It wasn't Clyde's fault. Her depressive and giving up behavior was as much of a problem as his overpowering behavior. They just needed to learn how to work out conflicts in a win-win way.
I'm just really interested on why you think that antidepressants would be helpful to someone. In what kind of situation would you use those, and why would you think they would be helpful?
Another excellent question. The situations in which antidepressants are helpful are several. First, if somebody repeatedly gets into depressions and had upsetting situations in childhood, the odds are that there's a relationship between those two. We know now that biochemically something changes when kids are upset, that there is something atypical in the biochemistry. We know that antidepressant medication seems to make the biochemical factory put out the right chemicals in a consistent way in spite of something being different in childhood. Also, people who have never had upsets in childhood may have a blow that just knocks them so hard that they can't quite pick up. We know in those instances that sometimes a short-term use of an antidepressant will just get their biochemical plant going enough that, especially if they're also getting psychotherapy or couples therapy, they can get back to normal quickly. Those are two situations where medication helps. I am not saying, though, that all depression needs medication, because, in fact, I would say maybe just 10 or 15% actually need medication. The rest need to learn to be more empowered as individuals, or if the problems have to do with what's going on in their marriage, they need to learn to work together in a more cooperative way. Did that answer your question?
Are you saying that their thoughts are what triggered the chemicals, and that you're just dealing with the biochemicals or whatever you're talking about in
yes.
their body, but you're not dealing with the cause of it?
All right. There are thoughts that are associated with depression, negative thoughts about yourself, about your future, about the other person. There are feelings associated with depression, and then that's that dark cloud, low energy. There's a biochemistry that's associated with depression. And there's action. When people are feeling helpless and ceasing to take action, like happened with Carl and his job, that's a fourth piece. So there's body chemistry, there's action, there's feelings, and there's thoughts. When any one of them goes down, it can drag all the other three down into a depressed state. And the opposite is also true. As any one of them goes up, as people get empowered, they begin to feel better. As they feel better, they begin to see new information and have different thoughts. They therefore can take new action, and their whole body chemistry changes. Today we were emphasizing the route of re-empowerment as a route that's particularly effective in changing all of those thoughts, feelings, biochemistry, and action. It's the route that I generally have found to be the most effective, to go back to the conflict, address it in a new way where there's a win-win solution. Then the thoughts go poof back into the positive, the feelings go poof back into re-energized and a positive state. People are ready to take action again, and the biochemistry changes. Sound like magic? You need to try it out. It does seem to work. It is not, however, the only theory in the literature or the most broadly accepted. It really is a new theory that's come out of this whole study of conflict and its resolution. Let's look back on what we've talked about. We've talked basically about depression and its connection with conflict. That when conflicts are resolved with a pattern that's dominant-submissive, with one side getting heard and getting what it wants, and the other side giving up, the residue of that decision-making pattern will be depression. It may be just a little bit of depression. It may be a whole lot of depression. It will be depression.
Depression, a disorder of power, has explained that depression enters when a person settles a conflict by giving up and leaves when a person finds a more satisfying way to resolve the disagreement. The information on this tape is expanded further in Dr. Heitler's book, From Conflict to Resolution, published by Norton & Company. From Conflict to Resolution can be purchased in bookstores or from Listen to Learn audio tapes. Other audio tapes by Dr. Heitler include Anxiety, Friend or Foe, and Conflict Resolution for Couples, plus an audio tape for psychotherapy professionals entitled Working with Couples in Conflict. For more information, or to order Dr. Heitler's tapes or book, contact Listen to Learn Audio Tapes, 1-800-919-8899, or write to Listen to Learn, 4500 East 9th Avenue, Suite 660, Denver, Colorado, 80220. Listen to Learn Audio Tapes encourages you to listen to tapes when you exercise, when you drive, during long-distance travels, and when you relax at home. Enjoy while you learn.